Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife. Larry Mueller here, so happy to have you with us today as we visit with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Questions for him, comments, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. And if you have a question or maybe a photo, wildlife photo, ID or whatever, give us put that on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd love to hear from you. Scott, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be back, Larry.
You've been traveling all over the place.
Yes, retirement's wearing me down. I'm going to have to go back to work. Things have been busier than I had expected, and of course, it was kind of a hot, humid summer that I don't. So I'm glad I was on the road a bit. And the most recent trip that I think might be of most interest to the listeners was a little fishing expedition to Alaska, and it was anything but hot and humid up there, and. Just a really cool experience. I had never been up and went with a group that had been and knew the ropes, so all I had to do was tag along, and lots of neat fish and lots of interesting wildlife. And as the fellow said when we first got out on the boat, he said, "Well, you know, it's kind of like everywhere you look, it's like a postcard," and it was really beautiful. So yes, lots of road time, but. It's good to be back. It's great that fall is right
around
the corner.
Yeah, fall's about here, isn't it? It's starting to feel a little like more like fall.
It is, and from a wildlife perspective, it's just a fantastic time of year from the standpoint of people who enjoy our wildlife resource for hunting opportunities. I think bear season opened today, doves and early geese last week, and a week from Saturday on the 17th, the archery bow season opens, and grouse up north and a turkey season. It's very busy from that standpoint, but from the animal standpoint in general, the reproductive season has wound down now, and the landscape is covered with food. The crops look great. I think there's a pretty good nut crop from what I've seen. As far as the animals are concerned, this is the time of year to fatten up and think about what's coming after a couple months of nice fall weather. So they're out and about. There are lots of them. Between fall colors and the bugs disappearing, it's just a great time to be out observing what's going on.
Absolutely. And lots of callers online with questions and comments for you. So, ma'am, should we take a call?
Why not?
Let's go to the phones here. Les in Wausau. On to you now. Hi, Les.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a question about a snake I saw on the road. I could see it from several hundred yards away. It was a very bright yellow with a black pattern, about 6 feet long, and it had a much smaller head than body. The body was probably 2.5 to 3 inches in diameter.
And where was the snake, Lee? Les, rather?
Up around Wausau area. I saw it in the middle of the road.
And you'd describe it as yellow or maybe tan?
It was very yellow.
Very yellowish. Well, one can never rule out the possibility that something weird's been released or dumped by somebody, but a big snake in that part of the state, kind of yellowish, yellow tan in color with markings on it, which you described as patches of color?
It was almost Aztec-ish looking with the design, black on yellow. I looked on the internet and it looked similar to a bull snake in New Mexico.
Well, I mean, the two likely candidates would be a bull snake, which gets pretty large, but that's pushing their range a little bit as far
north.
As a bull snake's concerned. So the next best guess, the common or the most common large snake in the northern part of the state is actually a fox snake, which most people call a pine snake. And especially since you described the head, did you get a really good look at it?
I did. Yes,
well, you described the head as fairly small. Were there any markings on the head that you could determine?
No, actually, the head had a reddish tinge to it.
Okay.
It was much smaller.
That confirms it. End of story. Bull snake would have tiger stripe kind of markings on the head, distinctively marked, but once you describe it as kind of an orange or brown or coppery-colored head, smaller than the body, then that's a big old fox snake or pine snake. So if you... if you can get a hold of one of the little DNR ID books on snakes of Wisconsin, a very good picture of a fox snake, or just Google fox snake or pine snake, and I think you'll see a picture of what you saw.
Well, but thank you.
They're quite common and do get fairly large.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling. All right. Kind of a neat sighting, though.
Yep.
Always fun to see something like that. Lee and Cutta, hey, we are on to you. Hi, Lee.
Hi. I was just wondering, I've been feeding hummingbirds. I just started this year, and I've got a lot of them coming.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But when do I stop feeding them? I'm in southern Milwaukee County.
Well, that's a common concern, yeah. Lee, is that, oh, my gosh, if I keep feeding the hummingbirds, they'll stay too late and they'll freeze to death and so forth. Like all birds, the hummingbirds know when it's time to clear out, and they'll likely clear out before you stop feeding. So the bottom line is my feeder's still up. I'm not too worried about it. Once the flowers have died back from frost and there's no more natural food supply, your feeder won't be enough to convince them to hang out when they know it's time to go. So if you want to be, if you're still a little bit squeamish about that, wait until we have had a killing frost, there's no more flowers for the birds to feed on, then you can discontinue your feeding and they'll be clearing out shortly anyway.
Yep, there you go. Good luck. Thanks, Lee.
Thank you.
And Dan in Partyville, on to you. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have two related questions. One's about bats. We sit outside at night by our fire pit and the bats are very active for about a half an hour and then they're just gone. Do they go to rest and then come out later on?
Well, they usually come out within about a half an hour of sunset, give or take a few minutes, and that's when they're very visible in twilight. Part of the issue is as it gets darker, they're harder and harder to see, so it might give the impression that they've disappeared.
Okay.
But generally they come out, they feed actively, and periodically during the night they'll rest or hang up somewhere, take a break, continue feeding, and then they're back in their roost right around sunrise or before.
Okay.
So they are active most of the night, but they do take a break just like anybody else who's doing something strenuous.
Okay, and I saw something really odd on Friday night. Nighthawks, they feed and they look a lot like bats.
Yep.
And they're kind of solitary. I've never seen hundreds of them together.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. That's number 4 on my hit list here. My colleague Jamie and I, who's on the program occasionally, were doing a workshop in northwestern Wisconsin a week ago Sunday up near Minong and Trigo, and we saw as we were out in the evening just a fantastic aggregation of nighthawks moving seemingly at random, but generally they gather up late August, early September, and just slowly drift south. And that's what you were seeing, a large group of nighthawks heading out for the season. And we mentioned it. One of our speakers was Andy Polios, ornithologist with the DNR. We were pretty excited. We said, oh, we saw almost 75 nighthawks. And Andy's comment was, yeah, I was just driving up from Stevens Point. I saw 271 or whatever it was. So the air was out of our sails, but I started to see them here as I got home in southern Wisconsin over the last few days. So that's what you're seeing. They're a neat bird. It's just one more neat thing to keep your eye out for in the fall.
Yeah, it was awesome. They're all gone now.
Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And we have Chuck in Bruce, Wisconsin. Hi, Chuck.
Hello. I was just wondering, there's been some talk around that the DNR has released snakes in the Blue Hills in northern Wisconsin to take care of some kind of bug or something.
Yeah.
I just wondered, is that true or not?
Sorry, Chuck. That falls right under the heading of urban legends. The most notorious of the snake releases was the alleged stalking of rattlesnakes in Door County to control turkeys, and various versions of that have cropped up from time to time, but snakes are not being stalked or released anywhere for any reason.
Now,
do we have any snakes in the Blue Hills that you know of?
What county are we talking about?
Rusk.
Rusk. Certainly. And the easiest way to figure out what is potentially in your area is to do one of two things. Either get the little book that I mentioned a moment ago from a DNR office or online called Snakes of Wisconsin, and there's a little colored-in range map of the state for each and every one of our 22 snakes. And you can see where you are or where you're interested in and come up with a hypothetical list pretty easily. The other possibility is to go online to something called Wisconsin Nature Mapper. The website is WisNatMap, N-A-T-M-A-P. And they record sightings of snakes that you can key in on to a particular area of the state. So lots of ways to do that, but certainly you'd have garter snakes. They're everywhere. You'd have red-bellied snakes. You'd probably have the fox snakes we were talking about a few minutes ago. And likely a half a dozen other species, too.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Poisonous. How many of those would be poisonous?
None.
None.
None. Okay.
The only two. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the only two venomous snakes we have are the Massasauga or swamp rattlesnake and the timber rattlesnake, which are pretty well restricted to southwestern Wisconsin and not particularly numerous. Mm-hmm. Most people don't need to worry about venomous snakes in Wisconsin.
There you
okay,
go.
Sir. You answered my question.
Have a good one.
Have a good one. Thanks a lot for calling. Let's turn to Brian in Cedarburg next. Brian, hi to you.
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Morning.
I'm an avid hunter, and with deer season coming up, I'm very curious to find out what is going to be the current state of CWD in the southern Wisconsin deer population and how that's going to be impacting the current hunting season. I'm sure there's been, you know, a good 10 years worth of data on CWD now in southern Wisconsin. I'm just kind of curious what the results of all that is.
Okay.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Well, here we go for the rest of the program. That's a tough question, Brian. We are almost 10 years into CWD since the discovery in 2002. It's been a long and bumpy road trying to figure out what's going on and what should be done about it. The DNR has a response plan in place that's currently guiding their activity. If you haven't seen them already, you'll notice public service announcements on television by Matt Kenseth and other celebrities talking about the new program, and the motto is called Hunt, Harvest, Help, to get people out to hunt, to harvest deer in the CWD management areas, and basically in that way help in controlling the spread and intensity of the disease. There's also a new website up called No CWD that people can go to.
That means K-N-O-W.
Yes.
No.
Yes, K-N-O-W, that's correct. Know it in the sense of becoming familiar with it. Anyone interested can link to that off the DNR website easily. And there are some videos.
That's a very complete.
It's a very thorough. If you're really interested in this, Brian, the first thing I do is go to that website, watch the video that kind of sets the stage for the whole thing, and it will lay out all the current regulations. The bottom line is it's still contained in the southern part of the state, fortunately. The regulations will be pretty similar to what we've had in the past with one notable exception, and that is that Earn a Buck has been suspended for the first deer, which is a big deal to a lot of people. In other words, someone sitting out in a chronic wasting disease management area in southwestern or southeastern Wisconsin can shoot the first deer that they wish to shoot, buck or doe. After that, if they want to shoot another antlered deer, they have to earn it with an antlerless deer. But that's a huge change, and it's something that people were calling for. We'll see what it does with the harvest. But nevertheless, in terms of you being an avid hunter, that's probably the biggest thing I could pass along as far as regulations changes.
Definitely.
In terms of what we've learned over 10 years, boy, we've learned a lot of stuff, but we haven't really learned what to do about it yet. No. in a definitive way. And it's hard to measure progress. The incidence rate has continued to tick up slowly from what it started at 10 years ago. The distribution, because we've looked diligently for it, is probably a bit greater than we thought it was initially. But the good news is it doesn't seem to be spreading, if at all, at least not rapidly. And we can only hope that the harvest actions and perhaps new technology, new techniques that people are working on will eventually give us the upper hand. But for right now, it's more of a holding action, and there have been some regulations changes to make things a little more palatable for hunters and landowners who are subjected to CWD.
There you go.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. I'd like to ask one more question. I'll take the answer off the air. I know when CWD first came into southern Wisconsin, a lot of people were worried about the disease jumping into the human species.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any actual documentation that shows that, or has it been pretty much disproven that this disease is not going to jump over to our species?
Well, it has not been proven that it can or that it has. but it hasn't been proven that it absolutely can't. So there's kind of that little narrow gap between it's highly unlikely and it's a zero probability. So no one that I there just haven't been any cases in other species like scavengers, like coyotes and fox, or domestic animals, or people. But having said that, you know, knock on wood, that's great news. But the it's not a zero possibility. It seems to be infinitely small, but there's still there's still perhaps a little concern in some circles. On the other hand, people seem to be in the area, in the affected area, seem to be trying to return to some level of normalcy in terms of deer harvest and consuming deer. They're still being tested. The high levels of anxiety that were present in the early years of CWD seem to have subsided. Mm-hmm. And there's no evidence that it's a major health concern for people.
Thank you very much for calling, Brian. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Brittany DeAnda, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, as we talk the world of wildlife with him. Questions, join us. Our lines are full, but the number is 1-800-642-1234. Shoot us a note on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show or email us at talk@WPR.org. And let's get to some of these Facebook comments from Mitchell in Grant County. Says, in the last month or so, I've seen at least 3 dead fox all on or beside the road, wondering about the population of foxes in the lower half of the state.
Well, I can't say a great deal about the fox population. I think they're doing okay. There's always been some concern with the various canids interacting, and they don't play well together. So wolves don't like coyotes, coyotes don't like fox, and so forth. But they're one of the animals that's around that seems to be doing okay, and I haven't heard any particular concern expressed for their population level. The fact that there were 3 dead ones along the road may simply mean that, hey, there was a den nearby and they've not fared well as far as traffic control is concerned. But I don't think there's anything there, Mitchell, to be particularly concerned about other than extreme misfortune for your local fox population on that stretch of road. Other than that, I just haven't heard anything that there's any statewide concern.
Mary had a Facebook comment relating to whitetails, which we were just talking about. Whitetails across the country have the same species name, but their size varies significantly. Southern adult doe can be about the size of a large Wisconsin fawn. Are these separate subspecies, or is it more a nutrition-environmental disparity?
Well, environment and nutrition certainly play a role in deer size within a given subspecies. But yes, there are subspecies spread across the country. The most notable disparity would be, say, the key deer down in the Florida Keys that are just little tiny guys compared to ours. But even within Wisconsin, where we're dealing with the same subspecies, you know, a deer on southern Wisconsin, corn ground, good fertile soil, lots of food, is going to be on average for the same sex and age class heavier than a deer trying to make a living in a Northwoods forest in say, Vilas County. But there are subspecies scattered around the country, ranging from the little tiny key deer up to the big guys here in the North Country.
All right. Let's go to Patricia in Portage. Hi, Patricia. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I write a new column for the Capital Times newspaper on every other Sunday online for wildlife lovers who want to protect our wildlife from being killed. It's called Mad Raven Speak. Mad as in Madison, Raven as in the bird, and Speak as in Speak Out. And I am really appalled that the DNR is allowing the running of 10,000 men with packs of dogs on our black bears starting July 1st through the end of the kill season, which is starting today for 5 weeks, for 3.5 months, right before they need to den and have fat on, and adding in those men to the slaughter of our bears, 5,000 of them will be killed in the next 5 weeks over packs of dogs and bait, most of them yearling cubs.
Scott, what do you say?
Well, Pat is correct. The bear season opens today, and I'm trying to find my notes here regarding that in terms of permits. As I recall, there were 9,005 permits issued for the upcoming bear season starting today. In three of the four zones, the three other than Zone C, the dog hunters get first crack. They alternate between the bait hunters and the dog hunters to give everybody what they perceive as an advantage in alternate years. The dog hunters have first shot, so to speak, for the first week, and then it's open to any legal harvest method. The notion of only cubs being shot is probably not entirely true. Most hunters do everything they can to avoid cubs for a whole host of reasons. The training period is an issue unto itself, and I realize that running bears with dogs is contentious. Some states have gone to fair chase bear hunting only, but bear hunting, the way it's done in Wisconsin, has a long tradition and is very vocally supported by a very active group in the form of the Wisconsin Bear Hunters Association. Now, while they're looking out for their own interests, they've also been extremely cooperative in recent years in terms of helping out with these bear population surveys. And bear hunters this year from all harvested bears will be asked to submit a tooth and a little 2-inch piece of rib bone to the researchers who are replicating the 2008 population study that determined, holy cow, we've got a whole lot more bears than we thought we had, which resulted in a big spike in the permits and the bear harvest. Now, all the concern over hunting over a pile of Twinkies or chasing bears with dogs can be argued, but I frankly don't know what the alternative is in Wisconsin, where we have numbers of bears now that are extending their range further south into more human-dominated landscapes. And there are going to be more and more bear problems with crop damage, with campers, with a whole host of other things. And frankly, the only lid we have on a growing and mobile bear population is the legal harvest, which the quota of which, as Pat's right, is a little over 5,000 for this year. But if the population is, in fact, in the 30,000-35,000 range, even that harvest, you know, is barely enough to keep a lid on things. So although I acknowledge that there's a lot of controversy over how bears are hunted in some sectors, it is effective. It has a long tradition. It's supported by most hunting groups, at least. And it is the, as I say, the only thing we have available to manage some of those bear problems, which affect people, whether they're bear hunters or not. Mm-hmm. So
there you go.
In a sense, it is what it is, but it is a very popular activity, especially in the northern part of the state, and it's underway again today.
Thank you, Pat, for calling. Appreciate it. John in Green Bay, we're going to go to you next. Hi, John.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. Scott, I've got a question on the range of pine martens.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they've been having a tough time in the North Country.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I ask the question is Tuesday morning I was talking to a friend of mine, and he had seen a pine marten, and it's the second time he'd seen it, just southeast of Stevens Point. He has some land there, and he was out walking in the woods, seeing what the deer population seemed to be. And his dog treed the pine marten, so he had a chance to look at it. It was pure white. And I was just wondering if, and I looking on the internet, I see that this would be real, be far south of their range. So I was just wondering what the range of the pine marten is in the population, if they have them, you know, recognized population in the central part of the state.
Well, hold fire here, John, just for a second. You're describing this animal that was treated as pure white, snow white.
Yes.
Not an albino, not pink eyes.
No, in fact, I just talked to him before I got on the radio here with you. He said he got a fairly good look at it, and that was one of the first things he checked because it was only about 10 or 15 feet above him in the tree. And he did... He couldn't determine that it was an albino.
Well, Let's start at the beginning. First of all, your assertion that pine martens have had a tough go of it is correct. They have had a very difficult time since the reintroductions decades ago. Unlike their close relative, the fisher, they have not thrived. Fishers boomed and spread all over the northern two-thirds of the state. The pine martens didn't, however, and actually there was concern about the survival of the few, perhaps several hundred individuals that were left after decades of protection. And as a result, some more pine martens have been reintroduced over the last year or two into a couple of very discrete areas in the northern part of the state. And I think if you want to see, you're also right that Stevens Point is well south of where these pine martens have either been restored or brought back in over to augment the population, or the remnant population that's been up there for a number of years. So I don't know what your friend, Treed, John, but first of all, pine martens are not white. They don't turn white in the winter. It's too early for any of the members of the weasel family, like long-tailed weasels or short-tailed weasels that do turn white, to be white. So if this animal was not an albino, I don't know what the heck it was. And but it probably was not, and I say probably in terms of a very high percentage, so like lots of decimal points after the 99.9, probably not a pine martin. Too far south, just not a large number of those animals left, even where they are found. So the probability of seeing one is not good, and the white is a bit troublesome. I have no idea. In the absence of a picture, I have no idea what he actually saw.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And we want to go to David in San Francisco, California next. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you? Boy, you know, I'm kind of glad I followed up that bear business. Did they really, was it 5,000 bears in one state are going to be hunted?
Well, the population estimate for Wisconsin, and they're currently doing some survey work to replicate a 2008 study to validate a population estimate of somewhere around 30,000 bears, give or take a number of thousands, whereas the previous estimate had been around half that. So assuming our population is in the range of 30-some thousand, then the number of permits issued, or not the number of permits, but the quota, I think was 5,000. So, I'm going to say it was just over 5,000.
So that's like 17%, 16-17%. But if you're wrong, then you'll end up killing 20% or 30% or something?
Wrong in what sense? The population?
The total population.
Yeah, I don't think there's any risk of that. I think that the once the information is collected and they've got these rib samples back from the bears have been exposed to a huge distribution of bait boxes, which are laced with tetracycline, which causes a little bit of discoloration in the bones, and that's how they're able to do this mark recapture mathematical analysis that was done in 2008. And given the number of bear sightings now moving into the southern and central parts of the state, the numbers of bear problem calls, and every other indication, I'm pretty certain that the current information is going to substantiate what they found in 2008 and maybe even up the ante a little bit. So I don't think there's a great deal of anxiety on the part of the bear managers or the DNR biologists that that there's a possibility of overharvest here.
Wow.
Even if all 5,000 are taken.
You know, it gets into another angle, and it reminded me, I read a book about one of the famous monarchs. I think it was King Edward of early this last century, 100 years ago. The guy was a nut for hunting. He would go out and shoot 20,000 pheasants in one day. These were all captured pheasants. You know, they would raise them in a pen, you know, and he would just have them released out of sacks and shoot them and shoot them and shoot them. He shot as many as 20,000 in one day.
Well, I'd have liked to have seen this.
Dick Cheney's shooting incident a couple of years ago was the same way. These are tame ducks that they keep in boxes, and they just release them, and the guy shoots them and shoots them and shoots them until he gets his bloodlust sated. So I'm just wondering, what's the average number of bullets? You know, if you passing out, bear permits, 5,000 permits in a year, how many average numbers of bullets are being sold for each permit?
Hmm. Wow. Probably not that many. For one thing, of course, the bears that are treed by hounds are shot in a tree. The bears that are baited are shot over bait. It's a pretty tightly controlled situation. It's not like the bear is running through the woods like a deer might be. So not a lot of ammunition is expended here. So that's trivial compared to, say, the Wisconsin deer season, where we, in a decent year, 300,000-400,000 animals, maybe as many as 500,000, taken by hunters. Now all of a sudden, you know, you're a hundredfold the harvest, and under a much less controlled circumstance in terms of the hunter's relationship to the animal. So the ammunition there purchased by deer hunters, of which there are many times more than bear hunters, is staggering.
There you
go. Anyway.
Thank you for calling, Dave. Appreciate it. Steve in Lake Geneva, on to you now. Hi, Steve.
Morning, guys. Hey,
morning.
This morning I was on my way to Milwaukee from Lake Geneva, and I noticed something that I don't normally see until early November at the earliest. There were several hundred cranes doing their spiral with the thermals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Going up over a cornfield. Most of the corn's not down now, obviously, because it's so early, but they were flying over the cornfield. I couldn't believe, and I started counting, and I'm thinking there had to be 300-400 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday I went out mushroom picking a little bit earlier than what I normally would, and I noticed that a couple of the types of mushrooms that I pick are done already. Is there a possibility? To me, my gut tells me we're going to have snow in October.
Oh, geez, don't bite your tongue. I'm not so sure about that. On the one hand, the transition to fall seems to have occurred over about 10 minutes this weekend. At the football game last Thursday night, we were nearly dying in the humidity and heat, and then all of a sudden it was 39 degrees in the backyard a couple of days later. But you know, there are a lot. I don't see, for example, the corn crop, which looks spectacular this year. It's still green. I mean, I don't see much evidence of the onset of harvest for crop fields. The sunflower fields that I've been in the last few days looking for doves during the early dove season are actually quite late in terms of their maturity. So most of the bird activity that the nighthawk movements that we just reported on, the swallows gathering, the blackbirds have cleared out, all seem to be pretty much on schedule. I don't see a whole lot going on that suggests it's going to be an unusually early fall or winter. And I think the projections in, say, the Old Farmer's Almanac or such things are looking at perhaps a fairly mild winter, which we're due for. We've had a couple of doozies.
Yeah.
What do you think accounts for that many cranes? I mean,
well, everybody, you know, whether it's cranes or anything else in the wildlife world, it is that time of year when they're starting to get ready to either aggregate or think about either moving out or getting ready to tough out a Wisconsin winter. So it seems a little early for big aggregation like that, but because we usually see large numbers moving over even into November, as you suggested, but they're still here, so that doesn't mean they're ready to leave.
Sure, sure. Does our state have that many local, like, resident cranes?
Oh, lots of cranes. Lots of cranes.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. That might have been it. Maybe it was the locals kind of gathering and. Okay, that's all I had to add.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks a lot for calling. We have an email from Bill in Sheboygan. Says, we have an older lilac bush, and recently I noticed that the bark as high as 7 to 8 feet off the ground was stripped off. Nearby, I noticed a hole dug by some animal with lots of dirt piled up at the entrance. Neighbors said they've noticed a woodchuck in the area. Could the woodchuck have gone up the lilac tree to strip the bark?
Well, as a matter of fact, Bill, woodchucks are basically just big, fat ground squirrels, and they're remarkably, for their stout behavior, they're remarkably good climbers. So I'm not sure we can necessarily assume that just because the chuck is digging nearby that it's the culprit, but it's certainly capable of doing so. It has both the climbing skills and the rodent dentition to do serious damage to a lilac bush.
All right. There you go. Let's go to Joe in Green Bay. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Thanks for your time. This pertains to the archery and gun deer season this year.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that we may archery hunt during the gun season this year. And if that is true, do we have to purchase an additional gun license along with the archery license.
Well, you're correct, Joe. This will be the longest archery deer season in state history, opening up next Saturday, the 17th, and running until January 8th, I believe it is. The only day that it's closed is the day before the gun deer season, which I think is November 18th. So it runs from the 17th of September to the 17th of November, closed for one day. There's no hunting at all that day before the gun deer season. Then it opens up again on opening morning of the gun season and runs continuously to January 8th. I don't think there's any additional license or tag or permit. If you're a legal archery hunter, I think the deal is that you can simply hunt with your bow now through the gun season. But I'm not a warden, and I'm not the final authority, so if you're at all apprehensive about that, I'd either check the DNR website or call up your area warden and ask, or call the information number with the DNR. But I'm pretty sure that all they've really done here is enable the archery hunters to hunt during the gun deer season under their normal system of license and permit.
There you go. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Thanks a lot for calling. On to John in Chippewa Falls. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. And thank you for having me. I have a comment and then a question.
Okay.
I heard something about delisting of wolves in the state of Wisconsin. I'm very well apprised of what's happening in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, to whereby they want to obliterate, well, particularly Wyoming and Idaho, they want to obliterate the wolf population. And if people are aware of the March 2010 issue of National Geographic, it very well addresses this wolf issue. Number one, since the wolf's been reintroduced in those areas, the indigenous population of animals, the flora and the fauna, has increased from what it was before the wolf was there. And why they're attacking the wolf, and they want to get rid of them when, for instance, they talk about livestock. Four times as many livestock are killed by weather, disease, and dogs. But are they killing all dogs out? No. But now what they want to do, Butch Otter, who is the governor of the state of Idaho, wants to declare an emergency and kill them down to a point where they can't sustain themselves. There'll be inbreeding and whatever. And I think this is totally immoral. And the reason they got this passed is some politician put a rider to get them taken off the endangered species list by putting onto a must-pass bill. Now, that's totally immoral.
Well, I'm going to break in here because I think you've got your point. We need to take a little break here coming up, so let's go to Scott.
I'll try and be quick here. The delisting of wolves in Wisconsin is a very contentious issue. The DNR is very staunchly supportive of delisting wolves, and I think wolves need to be delisted in Wisconsin. The problem here is confusing the situation in northern Wisconsin with the situation in the western states. Yes, they're wolves. There are some similarities, but there are some very important differences in states with a huge livestock history and a little different heritage of how they've dealt with wolves than here in northern Wisconsin. But the current snafu seems to be an interest on the part of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in exploring the genetics of wolves in this area. And, gee, are they the same as wolves in the Northeast, or aren't they, and so forth. And whether this is a productive line or not, I'm not sure. But the reality is wolves seem to be in pretty good shape in northern Wisconsin. They're continuing to grow in numbers. And eventually, we're going to have to come to grips with the age-old question, how many is enough? Before you see too many of the problems that led to the extirpation of wolves in the first place. I mean, what happened to wolves years back? They were persecuted to the point of being driven out. And I really don't think that human nature has changed all that much over the time interval here, Larry. So eventually, further, in my opinion, continuance of wolves on the endangered species list in Wisconsin, if it goes much longer, is not going to be in the best interest of the wolves or the state of Wisconsin. So I'd like to see them delisted along with the DNR.
Hmm. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Appreciate your calling in today with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or shoot us a note on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm getting a cold, Scott. My voice is going a little bit.
I'm sorry. I can't hear you, Larry. I'm moving to the other side of the room.
Oh, man. We had an email from Joe in West Bend. Several weeks ago, I found a dead rabbit between the houses where I live, right in the middle of West Bend. I went out to pick it up, discovered the head and the front paws were missing with the entrails hanging out. Any ideas?
Horned owl, local weasel, could be a number of things.
Yeah.
But horned owls are notorious for removing heads, so are some of the weasels.
Yeah, absolutely. Peg in Rice Lake, on to you. Hi, Peg.
Hi, I'm catching a cold, too, I think. Okay, on the gray wolf, if it's taken off the endangered species list, I think it's probably going to multiply. That happened with the coyotes. Out in the western states, which is the only place they were originally found, they killed those animals left and right, poison, traps, guns. Any means they could find, they killed coyotes to get rid of them. But what they didn't know until the park rangers out in Yellowstone did a study is that coyotes, like wolves, form family packs. They, when they are in a good pack, only the alpha pair breeds. And the others babysit, help get food, etc. Now, I think the same thing would happen to wolves, although they haven't been studied as thoroughly, but there are indications that they would, the same thing. If we start killing off the alpha pair, breaking it up, then everybody breeds.
Well, first of all, I mean, thanks for your comments. And it's true that the social structure of canid or dog groups, be they coyotes or wolves, are very complicated. And they can be messed up by all sorts of human activity, including removing the alpha pair or a member of the pair or whatever. But no one's really talking about any kind of all-out attack on wolves in Wisconsin if they're delisted. The agency's interest is simply being enabled to deal with wolf management the way they deal with the management of many other species. And where wolves might be a problem around a farm, then they would have the ability to remove a problem wolf, which they don't now. It's possible, and there's also interest, that somewhere down the road there might be a very limited hunt on wolves as a trophy animal, essentially. But it would be very limited and very tightly controlled. And I don't think in the case of the hunting, or likely the depredations control, that there's going to be a huge impact on wolf social structure that might affect the population greatly one way or the other. The difficulty here, of course, is in understanding that for many of our common species that are hunted, Canada geese, deer, and a whole host of others, the problems of those animals are not that hunting or control for problem reasons has resulted in a great reduction in the population. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Many of those species are problems of overabundance. And in many states, the hunting has almost been unable to keep up with population increases in deer and Canada geese and some other species that are very prolific. And for other species that are hunted, like ducks, for example, the continental duck population is the highest this year that it's ever been in the 50-some years that they've surveyed waterfowl on the North American continent. So that it's very difficult to equate persecution of a population, whether it's to control them because of some nuisance or damage problem, or by hunting, that this is going to be a problem for the population. The old days of market hunting, where populations were decimated, be they shorebirds or waterfowl or whatever, are long gone. Hunting is tightly regulated these days, and of course it has its own problems with loss of numbers of hunters, loss of land to hunt on, and a variety of other problems. So that, hunting and controlling populations, I don't believe is a major concern as far as wildlife populations for species that are in that situation. So we'll see where the wolves take us. But again, I would say that delisting in the long run is going to be, perhaps for some of the reasons that Peg mentioned, but for others as well, delisting, I think, is in the best interest of wolf viability here in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you, Peg, for calling. Mike in Madison, up to you now. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Morning, gentlemen. Very interesting and educational show. My question has to do with exotic pets that have become pests. In Florida, for instance, pythons and other snakes that have gotten into the wild, not indigenous, are a really big problem now. We know in Wisconsin we have a feral cat problem. Are there any other kinds of animals that are becoming a problem in Wisconsin now? And I thought about this when a previous caller talked about an animal that looked like a marten but was white. What kind of animals are the game people having noticed are proliferating in the wild and that they weren't indigenous or a problem mm-hmm. now?
Well, it's a very interesting question, Mike. We've been getting some good ones today, too. Mm-hmm. All of the contentious issues around the continent have popped up, but the notion of exotic pets is a huge issue. It's a bigger issue in some of the southern states where animals that originated in warmer climates can survive. One thing we've got going for us is a Wisconsin winter, and a lot of the kinds of things that are plaguing other areas, be it pythons in Florida or exotic parrots in some of the southern states and Southern California, a host of other things, simply wouldn't make it here, even if they get released. That's probably a good thing for us.
Those kinds of animals.
Pardon?
What about ferrets and those kinds?
Well, I thought about it. I was trying to think, what in the heck might somebody have let go that would be white that somebody might see up in a tree? And a ferret came to mind, although their extremities are usually dark, but some are pure white. I mean, that's certainly a possibility, is that it was something in captivity that was released or escaped. Part of it is unintentional. Well, I shouldn't say that. Part of it is an intentional release of these former pets when they just become too big or too problematic to keep in captivity, so they're shown the door. That is a very damaging thing to do. Part of it's accidental. I think it was Hurricane Andrew that smashed all these pet stores and distribution centers in South Florida, and all of a sudden the place was overrun with everything from primates to snakes and assorted other things, and they haven't recovered from that yet and may never recover from it. Around here, some of the issues, we've had some parrot problems back in the days of monk parakeets, and I think there's another one around now. There's a Eurasian goldfinch, I think it is, that's moved in. The issue with feral hogs is a huge problem in the southern part of the country. I think we've more or less got the upper hand on that, but we're not immune to that in Wisconsin. The cat issue, of course, in the form of feral cats has been a longstanding concern among wildlife biologists. But literally any pet or any domestic animal, not necessarily particularly exotic, that's allowed to run freely or simply becomes feral is a potential problem, whether it's feral horses in the western states, feral hogs in Texas, feral primates or snakes in South Florida. It is a big problem, and it's an unfortunate one because it's entirely the blame for this problem is entirely at our doorstep.
Yeah,
because of the interest in keeping exotic animals as pets. So,
well, thanks very much.
Yeah, yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Pat in Cottage Grove up next. Hi, Pat.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
I have a backyard that is overrun with chipmunks, and it's too wooded for hawks to come and take care of it. So I know there's live trapping. I think they beat you back to the house, and I'm not about to put poison out. I don't suppose there's anybody at the DNR that would like to come and release a few snakes in my backyard and do a study on whether that would help or not.
Well, probably not, Pat. I think that in a good chipmunk year, in a nice wooded backyard, probably with some stone walls or something like that, you've got the curse of the chipmunk. Now, they're cute little animals, to be sure, and some people enjoy having them around for the kids to feed and so forth. But They're still a small rodent, and they can cause problems getting into a garage or uprooting rock gardens and things like that.
And digging under plants.
Yeah, all that stuff, and then into the bird feeder and so forth. Now, they'll, of course, disappear with the onset of colder weather, but that's only out of sight, out of mind until next spring. You really are left to your own designs here. If the local predator complex can't help you out to the extent that you wish, you have to intervene, and if you're reluctant to use toxicants, that's entirely understandable. Live trapping is very frustrating in that it's not only slow to show return, but you have to find some place to release them where they're not going to be a problem for someone else, and that opens up the whole can of worms of translocating wildlife around the countryside. But frankly, if you're not averse to thinning out the population, a plain old rat trap is extremely effective, and it can be set under a board balanced against the wall or something so that you eliminate the problem of any non-target captures, which you don't want, like birds, for example. And you can thin out the population of chipmunks a whole lot more quickly with a rat trap than you can with a live trap. But, of course, they're going to be killed, which is okay on your property, but that's entirely up to you. Some people will want to do it, some won't.
Thank you for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from the Bayfield Chamber and Visitor Bureau, offering travelers all the colors of fall and local menus featuring fresh produce and fish during Bayfield's Fall Harvest Celebration. Fall getaway package information at bayfield.org.
On the next American Radio Works documentary, college students spend a lot of time in lectures.
At least until Gutenberg, the only valid approach to education was the lecture.
But experts say it's not an effective way to teach.
The classes only seem to be really working for about 10% of the students.
Listen for Don't Lecture Me, Rethinking the Way College Students Learn, from APM, American Public Media.
Saturday afternoon at 3 on the Ideas Network.
Sunny today in Wisconsin with highs mostly in the 70s.
Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The changing seasons bring us to observing wildlife on its way south and other places, maybe preparing to spend the winter here with us. Lucky to have Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, as our guest today and as our guide until 12:30 today. Do you have a question about Wisconsin wildlife, wondering where you might be able to see a particular animal or a bird or insect, or maybe you've spotted them in your garden or in your house and you want to get rid of them? Whatever the question, join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org. And don't forget our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Click like when you're there to get regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be back with Scott Craven right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here looking at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. All our lines are filled right now. The number normally to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email talk@WPR.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post there. Scott, we've got some permit deadlines and so forth. Before we go back to the phones, can we talk about that a minute?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk for a moment about the fact that, as we've alluded to, that boy, fall's here and wildlife populations are very active and will be very visible. And there's a lot of good news on the horizon. If we've talked a bit about the upcoming hunting seasons, but the reality is that these populations of animals provide great viewing opportunities and just a lot of neat stuff to see. You don't have to be looking for them with a gun in your hand.
You can
use a camera. You can just be out there listening and watching and so forth. So from the standpoint of the waterfowl population, holy cow, it's just a fantastic year for ducks across the country. So there are going to be lots of ducks around, and they're interesting to sort the species out. They'll be fun to watch all fall as they're migrating through. The turkey outlook is also pretty good, although it's they've suffered a little bit with some recent winter weather, as have the pheasants. Pheasant populations took another big hit this year. When you combine the spring surveys and the brood count information, which has just been released, pheasants seem to be down another 20 or 30%. Turkeys are down a little bit. On the flip side, there was wild enthusiasm over grouse numbers when it was released that grouse drumming counts were up 38% in the North Woods. Oh my gosh, we thought they were going to go down, and now they're all over the place. Well, the brood count information has tempered that a little bit. And while it's probably not quite as great as the drumming counts would have suggested, it's still going to be a really good year for grouse and woodcock in the North Woods. So people up there should be pleased about the way things are going to go. So overall, the outlook, and of course there's always lots of deer, the outlook overall is pretty darn good. But there are some things people need to be aware of. For example, with the turkey season opening next Saturday, this is going to mark the first time that you don't lug your dead turkey into the local gas station or tavern to register it. It's all going online or telephone. And that's been well publicized. People need to be aware of that major change. And someday we may see that for deer or some of the other species that have mandatory registration as well. There are still permits out there. If people missed the deadlines in August or in the spring for applying for fall turkey permits or some of the bonus deer permits that are available, they're still available. For deer in many units, there are still permits available. There are still surplus fall turkey tags available. So take advantage of those things. Don't leave them on the counter, so to speak. And we talked about some of the changes in the deer regulations. Bottom line is, if you are a hunter, you need to spend a little bit of time getting ready and trying to find out what the changes are that might affect you, where you are, or with the type of hunting you're doing. And there are still some opportunities out there for permits that you may have thought you lost out on, but did not. But overall, there's going to be a lot of stuff going on the next month or two, and it doesn't matter whether you're a hunter or not. Just get out there and enjoy it.
Absolutely. Susan in Bristol, we're on to you now. Hi, Susan.
Hello, and good early afternoon, and good to talk to you, Larry, and good to talk to you, Scott. I wanted to bring up something in response to what Pat had said about the chipmunks. I don't know if she's got chipmunks or pet squirrels, but they kind of all act pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I might have been listening to Scott before or to Patricia McConnell, but you can't really transfer those because the, another family, because they live in matriarchal societies under the ground, they don't like strangers in their house, the grandmas and the aunts and the mothers, they don't.
Yeah. So,
and they will kill the other ones. So if you want to get rid of them, you might as well, I think, just kill them anyway because otherwise, there is going to be like a big battle.
Yeah.
Well, Susan, I'm gratified to hear you say that because it's very difficult to advise people when you're not sure how they feel about lethal control. But the reality is that moving animals around the landscape, live trapping raccoons, rabbits, possums, chipmunks, it doesn't matter, and moving them around the landscape is probably ill-advised. It's not necessarily a humane way to treat the animals because, as you suggest, they may be released on turf that to the human eye, oh, what a nice place for a chipmunk. But holy cow, the landscape's already filled with chipmunks, and all of a sudden there's chipmunk on chipmunk strife, and they don't know where to find shelter or food, and all of a sudden they fall prey to hawks or owls or fox or whatever. So this notion of catching an animal in your backyard because you don't want it there and taking it out into the countryside or whatever. First of all, in Wisconsin, you need to have permission from the landowner to release any animal. I don't think many people pay attention to that, and they should. And secondly, if you stop to think about the impact on the animal, it's probably deleterious. So the bottom line is, in the case of population of chipmunks like that, it may be less stressful for the person with the chipmunk problem and for the chipmunks as an overall chipmunk population to just go ahead and use lethal control like the traps we described. So
good points. Comment. Yeah, thank you for calling. Roger in Spring Green, we turn to you. Hi, Roger.
Similar subject. I'm going to ask you to take it a little bit farther. I was wondering if you have any numbers about the the survival rate of relocated animals, any study we could look up online. And then as you answer this, if you could go into, going with the theme of the show and some of the callers, the carrying capacity of the land, and humans are part of the load on the land. So what would happen if there was no hunting, and we would have overpopulation of predators and prey, and to what end would that go? And would human attacks increase, particularly from the larger predators, bears, wolves? And also, would the vehicle accidents on the road happen, would increase? And do vehicle-injured animals often suffer to death if they're not killed at the roadside? Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, two big issues there. What might happen in the absence of hunting to some of the populations that are hunted? And the other one was, what information is available on the survival of translocated wildlife based on what I said about it perhaps not being in the best interest of the animals? Well, first of all, I have to say up front that moving animals around is not just done for the purposes of controlling problems. Animals are captured in locations and moved to other locations for valid wildlife management purposes. We talked earlier about moving pine martens, for example, into pine marten range to augment the population, which has been struggling. So movement of all sorts of animals around
turkeys.
Turkeys, for example. How did these turkeys get back? Well, they were translocated from the state of Missouri. So one cannot make the blanket statement that moving an animal from point A to point B is bad for the animal. It's, in fact, the basis for many very successful wildlife management and conservation programs. However, that's a little bit different when done in the hands of professionals for a management purpose than in the hands of a John Q. citizen who may not know anything about their habitat needs or seasonality or reproductive cycle or anything else. So that's an important point. There are many studies, particularly of urban raccoons, in terms of their compromised survival when they're moved around the landscape. And I don't have a great deal in front of me, but I'm guessing if you Googled wildlife translocation or wildlife survival, you would stumble on some of these. A lot of the really neat work on urban raccoons and urban coyotes done by a fellow named Stan Garrett, G-E-H-R-T, from Ohio State University, but he works in the Metro Chicago area. And I think if you look up some of his work, you'll get some information on particularly raccoons and coyotes. But there is a body of information that suggests that, sure, if you catch 100 raccoons in suburban Chicago and lug them out into the countryside and let them go, some will die very quickly. Some will be killed on the road as they're trying to find shelter. Some will just simply die. Some will survive and thrive. So blanket statements, one side or the other, are impossible. As far as what might happen in the absence of hunting to some of these game species, I hope we never have to find out. Certainly in the case of deer, I've seen some suggestions that the deer population could perhaps rise in the absence of hunting to 2, 2.5, 3 million or more from the current roughly half that. If that were to occur, I think the impacts on Wisconsin agriculture would be very serious. It would certainly make night driving more challenging, given the number of deer vehicle collisions we already have. It would be, in the long run, damaging to the deer population itself, either through the spread of what we're already dealing with chronic wasting disease or other problems. So whether it's deer, and we've seen what happens with Canada geese in the urban environment, and you have all sorts of problems in the city parks and whatnot where they're not hunted. Yes, I think the reality is that hunting, no matter how people feel about it, and although most hunters don't consider themselves providing any kind of public service, they're out there for the recreation and the meat and the camaraderie and a whole host of other reasons. But the reality is that regulated sport hunting as a wildlife management tool remains very important. And in its absence, I don't know what the heck we would have to do to control or keep a lid on some of these populations which thrive in a human-dominated landscape. It would be very problematic. So, there you go. Have it.
Bill in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I got a question about the deer population. I moved out 5 years ago from Massachusetts, and all of a sudden there's hundreds of deer out here, and in the fields and everything, and now I'm not seeing as many deer. What would be the answer to that question?
So you're talking about the area here around Madison?
Just in Wisconsin in general, because I travel around the state, and I'm not seeing the large herds that
well,
I saw 5 years ago.
That's correct, and the population is certainly down from where it was 5 years ago, and that's been largely through a very aggressive and diligent effort on the part of the DNR to get the deer herd back down to some approximation of their overwinter management goal. And in some parts of the state, it's still well above that. But here, particularly in the southern part of the state, where there's been a very lengthy harvest opportunity and very liberal harvest opportunity in an attempt to keep a lid on chronic wasting disease, I think most people would agree with you. It was quite when we drive into our driveway in the town of Oregon, and that we have a shared driveway, and the right-hand side of the long drive is an alfalfa field, where for most of the years since we moved to that home, my wife, well, every time we still drive, she said, turn on the high beams and turn the car. I want to see the deer. And it was pretty common to see five or six deer in that field every time we pulled into the driveway. Haven't seen one all season. And we've kind of stopped looking. So I think that the deer population is down as a result of aggressive harvest strategies. And in some parts of the state, that still needs to continue.
I don't see the deer population in the northern part of the state. They have, I would see them in fields, and I don't see that anymore in the northern part either.
Well, same situation, but different explanations. For example, in the northeastern, say, quarter of the state, the deer really got hammered there by some winter problems 2 or 3 years ago, as well as the harvest contribution. And a lot of those deer management units were relegated to no antlerless harvest at all over the past 2 or 3 seasons because the herd was way down. And those have started to rebuild a little bit. So there, don't get me wrong, there's still plenty of deer out there, and it'll be a very successful deer season. But seeing in some parts of the state the big aggregations or the very obvious deer that you used to see, that's not the case anymore.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you, Bill, for calling. Appreciate your call. Joe in Franklin, it is your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Great to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
We had a family of foxes living here. Now, they've been here for at least the last 3 years. This spring, she had 3 little ones. I think they all made it. And they just seem to have disappeared in the last couple of weeks. No one has seen them at all. I'm just wondering, I mean, when do the young ones leave the nest? Do mom and dad stay together for the winter? They seem to, the woman with the chipmunk problem, boy, you get some foxes, that takes care of that. And, I mean, I'm wondering, have they eaten everything in the neighborhood and just left?
Probably not. Most predators, not intentionally, but the way the system works, it's not in a predator's best interest to eat up everything. That becomes a problem. What ordinarily happens as the family units break up as you get to late summer or fall, the young will disperse and may move considerable distance. But a couple of things go on. For one thing, the reproductive season is over, so that visibility of a fox family comes to an end. In addition, the landscape, I mean, right now, it's jungle-like out there. You can hardly see at some intersections because of the corn. Vegetation is very lush. We've had a great growing season. It's just harder to see things that are, in fact, still out there.
Subdivision. I mean,
yeah.
You see them trotting right down the street.
And again, as fall starts, animals have other interests, and even some of the birds around your feeder that were regular attendees just simply disappear for a period. And there's also, of course, the possibility that something unfortunate happened. We would hope that that's not the case, but that's still a possibility as well. And that's often the first thing that people turn to. Gee, my fox has disappeared, or I haven't seen the squirrel with the yellowish tail or whatever. These animals don't have long lifespans. So that could be the explanation, but it could also be that, hey, it's just that time of year, young have dispersed, parents are out doing something else, hunting something else, situation's changed. I wouldn't give up on them completely. You may see them again, either later in the year or in winter when everything's visible, or they may be back again next spring. but I can't tell you for sure, nor can anyone else, where they are at this moment in time.
There you go. Thank you very much, Joe, for calling. And Dottie in Almond up next. Hi, Dottie.
Hi there. I have a question about this albino problem that I don't remember what you had called it, what the guy had called it before, but we have a trapper had called it a fisher.
Yeah.
Have you heard of a fisher?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Very common.
Okay. Could it be an albino fisher?
I mean, they're
in our area.
Yeah, there are a lot of fishers around. Fishers are closely related to pine martens. They're both members of the weasel family. Yeah.
Right.
But fishers have done very well and spread over. I mean, we've been seeing some turn up in the southern part of the state now. But a fisher is a much larger animal.
Oh, much larger. I didn't quite hear how big the pine marten that he had described.
He didn't describe the size, but seemed adamant that it was a pine marten. And then you're talking about an animal that really isn't a whole lot bigger than a big fox squirrel, whereas a fisher is raccoon size,
yeah,
and long and lean and long tail and very distinctive in appearance. So I don't think that's what it was, but good thought.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see, Patrick in Greenfield. On to you. Hi, Patrick.
Hello, sir. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm curious about the Asian carp, how we could stop this from getting into Great Lakes, because the nets they put up in Illinois, can't they jump over those electronic nets?
Boy, there's been a ton of stuff written about the Asian carp. If you don't subscribe to Wisconsin Outdoor News, if you can get the last four or five issues, they've been running a series on talking with some of the Asian carp experts and what could be done, should be done, what won't work, might work, and so forth. I guess I'd refer you to that. I think Larry and I both share your concern that we would love to see anything humanly possible done to keep that fish out of the Great Lakes, but our track record on keeping things out of anywhere is not that great. So,
is Illinois closing the docks? Their waterways to
the
lakes.
They're talking about various means of barriers. They were even talking about reversing the flow, I think, in one of those rivers. I don't know how the heck they do that from an engineering standpoint, but.
What would happen if you brought an endangered species like a bull shark up here, and would it die in the winter?
I suspect it would die in the winter, and our track record of bringing one animal in to control another one, often the cure becomes worse than the disease.
Yeah.
So that probably isn't in the cards. But in any event, there was a nice series of articles outlining what the situation was and the possible solutions in Wisconsin Outdoor News. So check that out. I think the back issues are available online.
Yeah, I believe they are. Good luck. Thank you. John emailed us from Fox Point. How might I introduce snakes and toads into my garden? I participate in the National Wildlife Federation's Backyard Wildlife Habitat program. My garden hosts many species of birds, insects, and small mammals. I have upside-down pots, woods, piles, everything I understand they might need.
Well, John, you're to be commended for that effort. That Backyard Wildlife Program is a Backyard Habitat Program is a great one. Wisconsin's always been a strong supporter of it. My thoughts on the matter, if you've got the kind of delightful and well-structured backyard that you describe, that the toads and snakes will find it eventually and be quite happy there, especially toads. The landscape, toads seem to be everywhere.
Yeah.
And once they get there, if you've got a shallow water garden or water feature that they can reproduce in, you'll have toads for the long haul. As far as the snakes are concerned, unless you're really isolated from any potential source like a greenway or railroad right-of-way or whatever, they too, especially things common like garter snakes, should also find it. But if you if some friend has a few snakes, they'd say, gee, I've got to get some of these garter snakes out of the backyard. Help them out. Put them in your backyard. See what happens.
Email from Karen in Madison. What's known about the pack of coyotes living at Eagle Heights on the UW-Madison campus? Can you comment on the possibility of a cat getting snatched off the end of a leash when tied to a building?
Well, coyotes have been implicated in the demise of lots of cats across the country from time to time. One taken off a leash, if a human is actually walking it, is probably pretty remote. But there have been cases of that happening as well. But a cat tied out and not attended to is, if the coyotes have become rather bold, that's almost like dangling a snack in front of them. So I think that if I needed my cat to be out, I didn't want it to run loose, but I wanted it outside, I'd get some sort of an animal container, crate, one of these big wire mesh things that's reasonably secure, and give the cat a fighting chance, as if you were diving in a shark cage. You don't want to dive with the great whites, but being in a shark cage is a different situation. Give the cat a little help here.
Scott, we are out of time.
Well, it went quickly. A lot of interesting questions.
Yeah, though. Lots of interesting things today. And you'll be back first Wednesday of next month?
Sounds like a good idea.
sounds like a good idea to me as well. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Just retired, but he's still working. So we're glad to have him around. And he'll be around with us first Wednesday of next month. Just to take a look ahead and see what's up for tomorrow, we're going to be talking about home renovation and repair at 11 o'clock. Chad Spade and John Viner will be here to talk about green and energy-efficient home improvements and repair, and they'll have some advice on how and when to get our heating systems tuned up for cooler weather. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.